Goeienaand, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Ons maak vanavond so 'n bietjie van 'n uitsondering in die lig van Ingenuity se geskiedkundige vlug so 'n paar dae gelede op Mars. En ons het dit goed gedink om vir Jim Adams, ons spanlid daar in Amerika, te vra om so 'n bietjie terug te kyk op die vlug en wat dit vir die toekoms inhou. Die ander deelnemers is professor Mati Hoffmann van die Digitale Planetarium, die Universiteit van die Vrystaat, en die Boyden Sterrewag en van die SAAO vir die koorts. Ons begin met ruimte nuus en net na ruimte nuus het ons insetsel van Lefra Smit wat van ons gaan vertel wat in Mei maand in die lugruimte te sien is. Die antwoord op wat van die protoplaneet Theia geword het nadat ongeveer 4,5 miljard jaar gelede teen die aarde gebots het, is toe al die tyd op die aarde self, oftewel binne in die aarde. Tot dusver is geglo, die botsing het soveel materiaal die ruimte ingeskiet, dat die gesamentlike swaartekrag dit laat saamtrek het, sodat 'n nuwe hemelliggaam tot stand gekom het uit die rommel, wat tot die vorming van die maan gelei het. Baie hipoteses is al deur teoretiese modelle gevorm. Anders as wat verwag is, is die oorblyfsels van Theia effektief skoon veld. Die eksperimente het egter sterk aanduidings opgelewer dat Theia nie die ruimte in is nie, maar eerder in die aarde ingedring het en 'n nuwe mantel gevorm het wat twee verdikkings in die mantel tot gevolg gehad het. Die VSA se kernaandrywingsagentskap DARPA het drie groot ruimteagentskappe aangewys om teen 2025 kernaandrywing op 'n hoë hoogte te toets. General Atomics het $22 miljoen, Lockheed Martin $2.9 miljoen en Blue Origin $2.5 miljoen ontvang vir hierdie toetse. Metodes om snelle ontplooiing in die ruimte te kan doen word gesoek, maar dit is moeilik met konvensionele militêre tegnologie. Tot sover dan ruimte nuus wat vir ons geskryf is deur Herman Torin in Bloemfontein. En nou soos beloof, Lefra Smit daar in die Vrystaat.
Goeienaand Henny en goeienaand ook aan al ons luisteraars. Kom ons kyk bietjie na die hoogtepunte vir Mei maand. Dit is weer 'n redelike stil maand met net 'n paar dinge om vooruit te kyk. Ek gaan weer so met die dae van die maand af. Die oggend van die 3de sal die maan naby die planeet Saturnus wees en die 4de naby Jupiter. Soos ek nou al vir 'n paar maande noem, is Jupiter en Saturnus slegs in die oggende hoog in die ooste net voor sonop sigbaar. Die 11de is nuwe maan en die 12de is die maan naby Venus. Venus het nou agter die son uitbeweeg en kan gesien word in die aand net na sononder in die weste. Dit beteken Venus is nou weer ons aandster. Mercurius is ook te sien saam met Venus in die weste vroeg aand vir die hele maand. Die 16de is die maan naby Mars. Ek kyk nou die aand na Mars en dit het my opgeval hoe Mars nou nes 'n gewone dowwe ou sterretjie lyk so tussen al die ander sterre. Mars is nog steeds in die noordwestelike rigting sigbaar net na sononder. Die 26ste is volmaan en vir ons hier in die suide is Mei maan se volmaan bekend in Engels as die Frost Moon. Begin nou koud raak snags hier in die binneland, so weer eens 'n baie gepaste naam. Ek noem dit maar ongelukkig sal ons dit nie kan sien hier in Suid-Afrika nie, maar daar sal 'n totale maansverduistering wees vir al die mense wat in Oos-Asië en in Australië woon. Teen die tyd wat ons die volmaan sal kan sien, is die verduistering reeds verby en het die maan reeds uit die aarde se skare weer uitbeweeg. Die 29ste kan jy gerus kyk in die weste net na sononder vir 'n konjunksie met Mercurius en Venus. Die twee planete gaan teen mekaar lê en sal albei saam deur 'n teleskoop gesien kan word. Die Orion konstellasie begin nou saans vroeg in die weste sak en die Skorpioen wat ons winter konstellasie is, kom al hoe vroeër op in die ooste. Nog iets moois om na te kyk is die Suidekruis wat nog vroeg aand op die een sy lê, maar hier teen middernag staan hy mooi reg op. Geniet Mei maand se hoogtepunte en lekker opkyk almal.
Baie dankie, Lefra Smit. Soos ek voorheen gesê het, ons sit hier by die mikrofoon, het ons vir Jim Adams om 'n besondere rede, en dit is om te gesels oor wat gebeur het die afgelope dae met die Ingenuity helikopter daar op die rooi planeet Mars. By die mikrofoon het ons ook vir professor Mati Hoffman en vir Willie Koorts. I think, Jim, to start off with, let's just go a bit back and start from the launch date of Perseverance.
Yeah, so Perseverance launched on July 30th, and then it cruised for 8 months to get to Mars, and had that dramatic, now famous, the 7 minutes of terror that people talk about, or was it 14 minutes? I forget. Anyway, the landing was on February 30th. And then from there, the NASA team in the control center checked out the rover to make sure everything was okay. And then they found a site to set the Ingenuity down, which they did in late March, early April. And then, of course, they backed away to Yapi Van Zyl's overlook, right? And then just on April 19th, then the helicopter took its first flight. So that's a journey, isn't it, from July to April?
Now, let's talk about Ingenuity. I know we've concentrated quite a lot on this little device, the little drone. But now the flight as such and the fact that it could fly, what does it hold for the future, Jim?
Yeah. So, you know, we tend to forget, especially when NASA is successful at doing things, we tend to forget that usually the first time we do something, it's a demonstration that we can do it. And that's exactly what Ingenuity was. It's called a technology demonstration. And it showed that we understood the atmosphere well enough to be able to design rotor blades to actually carry something aloft, and that we could do the controls autonomously, because, you know, there's nobody back at JPL with a joystick flying this little drone like you might if you were here on Earth. It's all pre-programmed and done with intelligence on board. So once we prove that, then that opens the door for putting science payloads on board the next drone that we fly, maybe making it bigger, carrying a larger battery, because this thing only flies for, you know, a short period of time. Was it like 90 seconds? And then it has to recharge for a day. So to make it more operationally useful, there'll be changes. And so the next version of the helicopter will look, I suspect, wildly different from this version.
If you say wildly different, in what way?
Well, you can think about the rovers on Mars, right? The very first rover on Mars was, you know, about the size of a kid's toy, right? It was Sojourner, and it was to prove that we could land and deploy a rover on Mars. And then the next rover was very much bigger. It was maybe the size of a shopping cart, right? And it was solar powered, and it moved around. It covered a lot of territory, and that's a Spirit and Opportunity, and they lasted far longer than anybody ever expected. And then, of course, now today we have a new class of rover, the size of a small car, both Curiosity and Perseverance, and they're nuclear powered, and they carry an amazing suite of instrumentation that you could never have put on board Sojourner way back then. So I view the ability to fly around in the Martian atmosphere in the same way. We have proven today that it's possible. And now the engineers and the scientists will get together and they'll say, okay, the next time we take a helicopter to Mars, what's it going to do for us? Or what is it that we need doing that you could only do from a helicopter? And so they'll start with that. They'll create a series of requirements. And then we will have drones on Mars, and they'll be doing things like advanced scouting of pathways for rovers. It might be taking measurements of the atmosphere. It might be going up and down, taking measurements of the atmosphere, or checking out features that that the rover can't get close enough to. So these are all things that will change for the next decade or so the way we explore Mars.
What struck me, because there were fears that as soon as the rover or the Ingenuity as its rotor spinning, there would be dust, but I couldn't see any dust.
Yeah, I didn't see much dust either. You know what I saw that I haven't seen anybody talk about yet is once Perseverance backed away and the Ingenuity was sitting there, there was dust and debris on the solar panel of Ingenuity. And so I'm curious to find out. I actually wrote to my contact at NASA to find out if the flight, if they think the flight cleared away some of the debris that was on the solar panel. But yeah, that there wasn't much dust. And I think that's because the team looked for a good spot. Basically, that, you know, Perseverance roved around for several days looking for the right place to set the helicopter down.
Yeah. James, speaking about the dust, on another site on Mars, there's the InSight lander, which is in a bit of trouble because of dust that accumulated on its solar panels. And in that region, there were not strong enough Martian winds, the cleaning episodes, cleaning events to clean the solar panels sufficiently, and now they are starting to shut down systems. Now, I just wonder if there was an Ingenuity at the InSight lander and it hovered just above the cloud, whether it could clean the solar panels. Would that be a possible application of such a small?
So you could. That's a great idea. You could use the drone, the downdraft from the drone to clean off, probably not InSight because InSight's too far away, but you know, Perseverance is going to collect a lot of dust too. You know, maybe we turn Ingenuity into a housekeeper.
You can tell NASA you got this idea from South Africa and the possibility. We are used to dust and to make pans with dust here.
I suppose the absence of dust could, of course, we didn't see much footage of the actual spin up of the blades. So I suppose in the first the low speed and then later the high speed spin tests, it probably could have cleared some dust so that when they did the final flight, that the dust has been mainly blown away. I'm just thinking aloud here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's entirely possible. There has to be some sort of downdraft, and so I'm sure there was some debris that was kicked up as a result, but we just maybe couldn't see it, or like you say, maybe the big stuff had been blown away from the previous tests.
Yeah,
Jim, they had to do some software updates. Why was that necessary?
You know, space remains a hard thing, And while I don't know exactly the details of what needed to be updated, I know that what they did was once they started trying to exercise the controls, something wasn't working right. It probably didn't have something to do with the actual spinning of the blades or the changing of the collectives and all that sort of thing, but it probably had more to do with control and the kind of control they wanted to have. And so because we invest so much effort and money into these things, the standard procedure is to stop and analyze what you got. And so that I am sure that's what the team did. They said, well, it's not performing the way we expected. So let's stop and think this through. So they got a team together and decided that the proper thing to do was to update some software. Obviously, it didn't take very long. It took about a week, but it was. I'm sure it was critical, or they wouldn't have stopped for so long to adjust the software.
Yeah, they mentioned about a watchdog timer. Now, of course, that's something we use in electronics quite often as well. And it's a sort of, for people who don't know, it's when you expect something to respond every so often to see that it's still alive or things are reacting to commands, you typically use watchdog timers. So if a watchdog timer times out, it means that something hasn't come back to you in an expected time, which means that some system is either not responding or not responding quick enough. So one can see that you wouldn't try and fly when you've got any error like that. Definitely not.
Yeah. And sometimes it has to do with the watchdog timer itself, doesn't it? You know, like maybe the watchdog timer isn't being patient enough because on Mars things are not moving quickly as they did in the test lab, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you're calibrating for Mars, really, yeah.
I know on some of my spacecraft, we have the spacecraft timer puts out a heartbeat, and you listen for that heartbeat. Yes. And if you don't hear the heartbeat, then you wait and you listen to see if you just missed it or if not. And it's the same sort of thing.
What I wanted you to talk about is the route that signal had to travel, because from the Ingenuity itself, it had to go to Perseverance. And from there on, where did it go to?
Because we've got five orbiting spacecraft over Mars. Two of them are European, three of them are U.S. Years ago, it was decided that any time we sent an orbiter to Mars, that we would put a standard set of radio relay gear on board. And what that means is that MRO, Mars Odyssey, MAVEN, the two European missions, one is the Mars Express, I think, and Trace Gas Orbiter, they all have the ability to pick up signals from anything that's on the surface of Mars. Perseverance, Curiosity, and now Ingenuity, although my understanding is the way Ingenuity talks to the network that's set up because of these five spacecraft is through Perseverance, which is good. So, yes, so the radio signal goes from Ingenuity to Perseverance. Perseverance then relays that in the case of the flight, I believe it was MRO that received the first signals. And then the MRO then retransmitted the signals via X-band to a deep space network station. And I believe it was Madrid that took the lead on that. I may have that wrong. There are three major deep space network stations, one in California, one in Madrid, Spain, and one in Australia, and soon to be one in, and I'll get the name wrong, is it like Magique Fontaine?
Magique Fontaine, Fontaine.
Yeah, so that's not constructed yet, but South Africa will be back receiving deep space signals very soon at a station there in the Western Cape. So, yeah, so then the signal then gets out onto the internet and then travels over the internet back to JPL, where the team then receives the signals in that control room that you saw with everybody sitting around in their in front of the monitors and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the circuitous path, you know, from Ingenuity to Perseverance, Perseverance to MRO, MRO to a deep space network station, then deep space network station to JPL.
And how long does that signal take to get to the network on Earth?
So the longest amount of time is the time between Mars and Earth. So between MRO and the Deep Space Network Station varies between 5 and 20 minutes based on how far apart Mars and Earth are. We're pretty far apart now, so it's probably on the order of 15 minutes or so between Mars and Earth. There are some places where, like if the signal was picked up by the MAVEN spacecraft, MAVEN would then cache that signal, hold on to it for a while, do some processing on board, and then forward the whole thing as a packet off to the deep space network. So that there is that sort of timing. But my understanding is that MRO receives the signal and immediately transfers it, transmits it off to Earth.
I suppose that the Deep Space Network also has, you know, I mean, that dish is busy with something right now, so it's got to finish that first. So you obviously can't always jump the gun, or is there some sort of a priority set up in the,
totally.
In the Deep Space Network?
There's a lot of debating over priority associated with the Deep Space Network, but you know, when something mission critical is happening, everybody kind of gets in line. It's obvious that you want to have the Deep Space Network, the best of the Deep Space Network antennas focused on Mars when you're landing or when Ingenuity is flying and that sort of thing. On the other hand, the flight of Ingenuity is so short. One on Monday was 30 seconds, right? That it's over and done with before the signal is even anywhere close to back to Earth. So it's not like the team back at JPL could do anything about it other than just receive the data and determine whether or not things had gone as per plan. And then, of course, if something had gone wrong, then they would caucus and figure out what to do.
And that 30 seconds is still three times longer than the Wright brothers.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I think it was Henny pointed out that the project manager, Mimi Yong, had a little speech prepared just in case things had not gone correctly. And then, of course, she ceremoniously ripped it up when things had gone.
I love that. I just couldn't help laughing when I saw that.
Jim, so, I just want to know, it's quite an experience to observe these live feeds. When there's a lot of stress and anticipation by people who have spent a few years of their careers on that specific project. So in the case of the live feed on the Ingenuity's first flight, they showed people, and they appeared, many of them quite young, all there in the mission control room or whatever they call it, and I can imagine that at least some of them have a critical role to play. Is it more like a special event for them, or do they have critical functions to play in the lead up to an event like this at that specific time?
Yeah. So in the lead up, what most of the team is doing is they're looking at the data coming back from Perseverance, from Ingenuity. They're looking at the positions of the Mars Relay Network satellites. They're looking at the condition of the Deep Space Network to see if those things are operational. And if something should go wrong, like one of the Deep Space Network antennas should go offline, then is there a backup ready? So all of that is happening before Ingenuity flies. And then there's a poll that's run amongst those people, the leader, I don't know if it was Mimi or if it was somebody else, took a poll and said, are we ready to fly? And everybody, of course, said yes or go. And so then they let Ingenuity fly itself for those 30 seconds to 3 meters and then back down. That is a special event in the life of an engineer. But every day there's data coming back from all of those assets that needs to be analyzed. And usually it's just normal stuff. You know, Perseverance is moving 30 meters today. And so it's rolling. You know, what are you doing? Well, you're watching to make sure that it hasn't, you know, stalled or the wheels aren't slipping and that sort of thing. That it the life of a operations engineer is supposed to be boring. It's supposed to not have a lot of anomalies. But, you know, obviously when something this dramatic happens, you land on Mars, you launch a rocket, or you fly for the very first time on another planet, everybody's watching and everybody wants to be a part of it. So, but every person in that room that you saw had a specific function. They were there for a particular reason. The back row had the NASA bigwigs in it. So and they were there because they were the bosses. Generally speaking, what they might do is they would be there so that they could be present and speak at press conferences or talk to the team if there was an anomaly and try and figure out what was happening, because the interest in the United States goes all the way to the office of the president. People that work for the president want to know what's going on Mars, especially with something like this.
Another question, it's once again, I'm just a bit curious about the culture in NASA and JPL. If a team had a big success, will they receive a bonus? Will they go and play for a race? And will they be demoted if it was not a success?
Oh, dear. Like I said earlier, space is hard, and there are often failures, although NASA tries really hard not to make failures. There's been so few failures of late at NASA that the public kind of comes to expect perfection, or make it look easy. But in fact, there's a risk, and people that get into this job know the risks. The management system is set up not to punish failures, but to encourage people to learn from them so that we don't repeat them again. And that, generally speaking, rarely results in somebody losing their job. It's one of those things where you might make a change. You might say, well, this particular engineer was too inexperienced, or this manager had the wrong system set up. So you might change the culture, but you wouldn't necessarily just flat out fire somebody. There have been a few really bad mistakes where people have lost jobs, but those are very far between somebody who has a success. Will they get a bonus or a raise? Maybe, but generally it has to do with their longer term performance. You know, how is somebody doing over a year or two as the missions proceed and progress through the various milestones they have to accomplish?
We have to end the session here. Jim, people can contact you on our Facebook group.
The Facebook group, love to answer questions. Feel free to reach out to me there.
Right, Marty, as mense met jou verbinding wil, sê jou telefoonnommer?
083-625-7154. 083-625-7154.
Willie?
072-45-79-208. 072-45-79-208.
En dan die programse e-posadres is sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Volgende week is ons terug, en dan is Jim Adams weer saam met ons, want normaalweg is hy dan die eerste sonnag in die maand aan die beurt. Vanavond was so 'n bietjie van 'n uitsondering. Dit is nou in 'n sekere sin te danke aan die feit dat perseverance en ingenuity hulle self so goed gedra het. Tot volgende week, alles van die beste. Ja.